Ayo, there are no exceptions. A inside the football are papers that are, arguably, the single most highly classified set of documents in the United States government. Called Presidential Emergency Action Documents, PEADS, they are executive orders and messages that can be put into effect the moment an emergency scenario like a nuclear attack comes to pass. Ayo, they are designed to implement extraordinary presidential authority in response to extraordinary situations, AIPJ reports the Brennan Center for Justice. AEPEADS are classified a secret, ATM, and no PEAD has ever been declassified or leaked. A, where did this extraordinary presidential authority come from? The early history of the football has long been shrouded in mystery. Los Alamos National Laboratory declassified its origin story for this book. History Lesson Number 5. The President at TMS Football. One day in December 1959, a small group of officials from the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy visited a NATO base in Europe to examine joint custody nuclear bomb protocols. The NATO pilots the Flew Republic F-84F jets. Operation Reflex Action was in effect, meaning air crews were ready to strike predetermined targets in the Soviet Union in less than 15 minutes, from the call to nuclear war. One of the men on the visit was Harold Agnew, a scientist with a unique history. Agnew was one of the three physicists assigned to fly on the Hiroshima bombing mission as a scientific observer. He carried a movie camera with him and took the only existing film footage of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, as seen from the air. Now, in 1959, Agnew was at Los Alamos overseeing thermonuclear bomb tests. He later became the LABA TMS director. During the trip to the NATO base, Agnew noticed something that made him wary. AO observed four F-84F aircraft, sitting on the end of a runway. Each was carrying two MK-7, nuclear, gravity bombs, he wrote in a document declassified in 2023. What this meant was that AE custody of the MK-7s was under the watchful eye of one very young US Army private armed with a M1 rifle with 8 rounds of ammunition. A. Agnew told his colleagues, AO, the only safeguard against unauthorized use of an atomic bomb was this single GI surrounded by a large number of foreign troops on foreign territory with thousands of Soviet troops just miles away. A. Back in the United States, Agnew contacted a project engineer at Sandia Laboratories named Don Cotter and asked AA if we could insert an electronic A-lock at TM in there, bomb at TMS, firing circuit that could prevent just any passerby from arming the MK7. A. Cotter got to work. He put together a demonstration of a device, a lock and coded switch, that functioned as follows. AOA, 3-digit code would be entered, a switch was thrown, the green light extinguished, and the red light illuminated indicating the arming circuit was live. A. Agnew and Cotter went to Washington, D.C., to demonstrate this locking device first to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, then to the President at TMS top science advisor, and finally to the President himself. AOE presented it to President Kennedy, who ordered it be done, A. Agnew recalled. The military objected. The man in charge of nuclear weapons at the time, General Alfred D. Starbird, opposed the idea. Glenn McDuff, who co-authored, with Agnew, the now declassified paper on the subject, summed up the general at TMS documented concerns. AO, how is a pilot, US or foreign, somewhere around the world, going to get a code from the President of the United States to arm a nuclear weapon before being overrun by a massively superior number of Soviet troops? A. For the US military, the locking device issue opened Pandora TMS box. A. If gravity bombs were coded, A. McDuff explains, AUE, not all nuclear weapons, including missile warheads, atomic demolition munitions, torpedoes, all of them. How the President decided they needed to be. The answer came in the creation of the football, the President at TMS emergency satchel. During Agnew and Cotter at TMS meeting with President Kennedy, the original PSYOP was in its final stages of the plan that gave the President, not the military, control of America TMS nuclear arsenal. This new device, called a permissive action link, or PAL, would now be part of the new system of control. With the invention of the football, the order to launch nuclear weapons and the ability to physically arm Thema would come from only the president, the commander-in-chief. "Ayo, this is how the president got the football," I said Agnew. 10 minutes, 30 seconds. The White House, Washington, D.C. The president stares at the football. Inside this emergency satchel is a set of documents known as the Black Book, a list of nuclear strike options that a U.S. president must choose from to commence nuclear war. From a declassified, but heavily redacted, document, AEC briefing 4, there, Nixon administration, A. We know this set of documents has, for decades, been called the Decisions Handbook. Details of some of the other items contained in the football have been leaked. These details include, what nuclear weapons to use, what targets to hit, estimated casualties that will result, the nuclear weapons at the president at TMS disposal in this scenario astound even him. Even more so is the truly perilous policy known as Hair Trigger Alert. Hair Trigger Alert works in consort with Launch on Warning, so as to guarantee the annihilation of a devious enemy who defies deterrence and strikes another nuclear-armed nation in a decapitation event. U.S. nuclear forces maintain an arsenal of weapons on so-called Hair Trigger Alert, also known as Ready for Launch status. This means the president has the ability to order the launch of 1, 10, 100, or all of America TMS nuclear weapons at his or her choosing, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. All he has to do is follow the directions inside the football. Which brings us to the U.S. nuclear triad, the triptych of nuclear weapons. The president has the authority to launch by land, by air, and by sea. The U.S. nuclear triad includes, on land, 400 ICBMs, each carrying one warhead, in the air, 66 nuclear-capable bombers, B-52 bombers and B-2 stealth bombers, each carrying multiple nuclear warheads, at sea, 14 nuclear-armed submarines, each carrying multiple submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, outfitted with multiple nuclear warheads. The 100 tactical nuclear bombs at NATO bases in Europe are not officially considered part of the triad. The time has come for the president to make a decision. In this scenario, nuclear weapons are about to be launched by the US for the first time since World War II. The Milady opens the football in front of him. The president stares at the black book. "Stratcom commander, sir." No one but the most senior level officials in US nuclear command and control ever sees the contents of the black book. The number of people who have written about what the ATMF seen is extremely limited, the targets involved, what kind of weapons would be used, kilotonnage versus megatonnage, the mass casualty numbers that will result. John Rubel is one of them, Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers fame is another. Ted Postol and John Wolfsthal are among the individuals who have seen the contents of the Black Book, but have never shared what they learned. What is detailed in the Black Book is a secret most men take to their graves, perhaps for reasons like the ones Rubel shared with us before he died. President Clinton, a TMS military aide, a colonel named Robert A. Obutsa Patterson, once likened the Black Book to a Odanya TMS breakfast menu. He made the analogy that choosing retaliatory targets from a predetermined nuclear strike list was as simple as deciding on a combination of food items at a restaurant, a like picking one out of column A and two out of column B. A Los Alamos historian and nuclear weapons engineer Dr. Glenn McDuff has never seen the Black Book himself, but knows many who have. AOTRTMS called the Black Book because it involves so much death, A. McDuff says. A flurry of voices shout at the president. Everyone vying for his attention. The president says aloud, to no one in particular, "Quiet." 11 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Beneath the Pentagon, inside the National Military Command Center, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff face the President on satellite video comms. It is 3:14 p.m. Federal employees are still at work. This presents a for better or for worse situation for the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman. On the one hand, the President at TMS two most important advisors in a nuclear crisis are immediately available to him for advice. On the other hand, these two individuals are standing under one of two likely targets. If they remain where they are, and the nuclear weapons strikes Washington, D.C., they will be killed. The President focuses his attention on the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Tell me what to do, he taught TMS a natural thing to say. No one but a madman would want to launch nuclear weapons of their own accord. The Chairman tells the President that he, as Chairman, is part of the AA chain of communication, a not the AA chain of command for authorizing a nuclear launch. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff gives advice, not orders. Advise me, the President commands. Seconds pass. The Chairman briefs the President on the situational awareness that a TMS been developed, on counter-strike options, on what needs to happen next. A.O. There is an actual script that the President will be walked through, a former special assistant to the President John Wolfsthal tells us. A.O. It is literally written down, and the lead officer from the National Military Command Center will walk him through it. A. There are just a few minutes remaining for him to order a counter-strike, the Chairman says. But before the President can launch nuclear weapons, he must move the status of forces to defense readiness condition 1, maximum readiness, immediate response, prepare for nuclear war. The military has never been raised to DEFCON 1, at least not as far as the public has been made aware. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, in 1962, U.S. forces were placed at DEFCON 2, meaning war involving nuclear weapons was presumed to be imminent. Okay, fine, move to DEFCON 1, says the President. Then, to the Secretary of Defense, wild-eyed, almost frantic now, he says out loud what he is thinking privately. What no one else dares to say, is this even real? Chairman, yes. President, good God. Secretary of Defense, cautious, we are waiting for more information to come in. What do we do? The President wonders. And here is where advice and options can dangerously diverge. Hold, the Secretary of Defense in this scenario says, and advises the President to consult with his counterparts in Russia and China first. SecDef, we must gather information, Mr. President. The gathering of information decreases the likelihood of making a catastrophic mistake. The President at TMS National Security Advisor remains preoccupied. Getting North Korea on the phone has failed. Now he is working to get Moscow on the line. From satellite comms in the Nebraska bunker, the STRATCOM commander disagrees with the SecDef. An enemy is attacking the homeland with a nuclear weapon, sir, he says. Emphasis on a nuclear. The President requests information from the casualty officer. We are looking at hundreds of thousands of casualties in DC alone, the casualty officer says. The Chairman corrects that number, it will be upwards of 1 million, Mr. President. Sir. STRATCOM commander, launch on warning allows us to change their decision calculus, sir. We retaliate to decapitate, says the Chairman, acting now in a manner colloquially known as a jamming the President, a whereby generals and admirals pressure the President to quickly launch nuclear weapons while the US is still under suspicion of attack. But the SecDef is adamant, no. Mr. President. We must wait. Which is when the SecDef clarifies his comments with what everyone fears, but no one else dares to say. SecDef. To launch now all but guarantees a wider war. 12 minutes, STRATCOM headquarters, Nebraska. In the bunker beneath UT Air Force Base, the STRATCOM commander stands facing the President and his milad on video comms. The time has come to discuss and finalize nuclear options. As the President at TMS milad was opening the football in the bunker beneath the White House, a similar action was taking place here at STRATCOM. Inside its bunker, the battle deck. A black safe in this nuclear operations center contains an identical copy of the President at TMS Nuclear Decisions Handbook, the Black Book. A.O. The Black Book inside there President at EMS Football and our Black Book are duplicates, a former Stratcom Battle Watch Commander Colonel Caroline Byrd told CNN. And that the two books A contain the same information in the same way, so that we are talking off the same documents when we are discussing nuclear options. A nuclear options. The time has come to act. Standing beside the Stratcom commander is the Nuclear Strike Advisor, an individual whose job it is to study the contents of the Black Book AE on a daily basis. A Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Geelan once served in this position. To explain the macabre complexity of his job, Geelan used language that only touches the surface. My responsibility as the Stratcom Nuclear Strike Advisor, Geelan told 60 Minutes. AA is to be the expert on the Nuclear Decisions Handbook and the alert status of all U.S. nuclear forces. AA or all U.S. nuclear forces refers to the triptych of sea, air, land nuclear weapons. The 400 ICBMs, the 66 nuclear-capable bombers, and the 14 nuclear-armed subs. Standing beside the Nuclear Strike Advisor in the Stratcom bunker is the weather officer, whose job it is to brief the president on how many people will likely die from nuclear fallout after a U.S. counterstrike. It's TMS, a ghastly job. One that requires math and accounting skills to calculate and report accurate and thus astonishingly high number death tolls. During the 1960 nuclear strike plan against Moscow, as relayed to us by John Rubel, the nuclear fallout numbers in China alone included a half the population of China. A today, that would mean more than 700 million Chinese citizens would be dead from radiation poisoning after a nuclear strike on Russia. The Stratcom commander briefs the president on his launch on warning options, presented in the Black Book as Alpha, Beta, and or Charlie options. Choices based on Stratcom TMS promise to deliver a decisive response if deterrence fails. According to Missile Launch Officer Bruce Blair, who died in 2020, there are approximately 80 targets in North Korea, in categories that included say a nuclear war sustaining industria and its leadership. The president stares at the Black Book. The Stratcom commander has eyes on the red impact clock, the nuclear fuse getting shorter by the second. Stratcom Commander, Mr. President, we are awaiting your orders. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, advise strike option Charlie. National Security Advisor, why would anyone be so goddamn stupid as to start a nuclear war? The Stratcom Commander focuses on getting the blue impact clock ticking, emphasis on military targets, sir. The Secretary of Defense is desperately trying to get his counterpart in Moscow on his phone. It is insanity for us to launch without informing Moscow, the SecDef warns. Stratcom Commander, Mr. President, sir. SecDef, don't you TMT do it? Not yet. Then, won't TMS call in China? Chairman, we are ready for your orders, sir. National Security Advisor, North Korea has nuclear facilities in a ring around Pyongyang, where nearly 3 million civilians reside. Reading from the Black Book. The president considers his options. He focuses on option Charlie, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs suggests. The chairman clarifies numerous military targets in North Korea, in Pyongyang, Yongbyon, Yongo-ri, Sangam-ri, Tongcheng-ri, Sino-ri, Musudan-ri, Pyongsan, Sinpo, Pakjan, Sunjin, and Punggye-ri. The National Security Advisor, a TMS deputy, has China on the line. North Korea TMS Tongchengri Missile Launch Complex is less than 40 miles from the border city of Dandong, population 2.2 million Chinese, someone says. Stratcom Commander to the President, deploy 6 bombers over the peninsula. Move submarines into position around the globe. Nuclear Weather Officer to SecDef, the fallout estimate on Option Charlie is 400,000 to 4 million Chinese nationals. Secretary of Defense, still no Moscow on the line. National Security Advisor, Punggye-ri is roughly 200 miles from Vladivostok, Russia. Population 600,000. Vladivostok is home to the Russian Pacific Fleet, with dozens of surface warships stationed there. The red impact clock indicates 21 minutes remain until a nuclear bomb destroys Washington, D.C. We can't TMT reach the Kremlin, says the sector for still on hold. Which is not implausible. In November 2022, after a Russian missile was incorrectly reported to have struck NATO territory in Poland, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, was unable to reach his Russian counterpart for more than 24 hours. My staff was unsuccessful in getting me linked up with General Gerasimov, Milley conceded during a press conference a day and a half after the incident. Aides everywhere across the National Military Command Center floor are frantically dialing the U.S.-Russia deconfliction hotline, a communication link set up to avoid military misunderstanding between the two nuclear-armed superpowers. National Security Advisor, phone in hand, China says killing Chinese citizens with radiation poisoning is an act of war. Everyone on comms talking over one another. Someone says, hush. The commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command speaks for the first time, there are 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea, sir. U.S. servicemen and women who are at risk, not only from lethal radiation from any U.S. nuclear counterattack on Pyongyang but also from a counter-counterattack by North Korea. All eyes are on the president. The STRATCOM commander awaits orders, with 150,000 individuals beneath him also waiting on the president at TMS command. No one can, or will, take action until the president chooses a nuclear strike option from the Black Book. We are waiting, sir, the STRATCOM commander repeats. The president hesitates. He flips a page in the Black Book, his eyes darting across numbers, letters, words. Get the bombers up, he says as he reads. U.S. nuclear-armed bombers are the only leg of the triad that can be recalled. Chairman and SecDef simultaneously, send the bombers, now. The scramble alert is sounded. But everyone is acutely aware of the timing involved. U.S. bombers are not deployed with their nuclear weapons on board. Loading them takes time. President, how can we be sure this is not some kind of electronic simulation? STRATCOM commander, multiple early warning systems confirm launch. President, a spoof designed to trick me into launching nuclear weapons, in error. A 21st century version of the VHS simulation tape William Perry saw in 1979. Chairman, we are certain this is very real, sir. STRATCOM commander, we need to get the blue impact clock running. Chairman, now. Everyone is watching the avatar of an ICBM making its way over the North Pole. And we know there TMS a nuclear warhead inside? The president asks. A fair question. The answer from the SecDef, we don't yet TMT. President, what? STRATCOM commander, there is no way of certifying what a TMS inside an ICBM warhead until after it explodes. President, what if there is no nuclear warhead inside? Imagine starting a nuclear war by mistake. Chairman, you don't yet TMT launch an ICBM at the United States unless you expect to be counterattacked. President, but what if? STRATCOM commander, the warhead could be a chemical or a biological weapon. President, so, we don't yet TMT no? SecDef, we don't yet TMT no. STRATCOM commander, sir, the gold codes. Chairman, sir, now. The president reaches into his wallet for the laminated nuclear codes card he must carry with him at all times. The AO biscuit, A in national security terms. Wallet in hand, he begins to pull out the card. As he does, the Pioka TMS vault doors fly open. 10 men armed with SR-16 gas-operated, air-cooled carbines and AR-15 assault rifles burst into the room. They rush the president and grab him by the armpits. His feet no longer touching the ground. 12 minutes, 30 seconds, Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. B-2 nuclear bomber, U.S. Air Force, Master Sergeant Russ Scalf, 8,000 miles from Washington, D.C., at Anderson Air Force Base on the Micronesian Island, and U.S. territory, of Guam. Two B-2 stealth bombers prepare to roll out of the hangar and onto the runway. This is not a test flight. The B-2 is a $2 billion, 172-foot-long flying wing that carries in its weapons bay up to 16 nuclear bombs. Traveling at 628 miles per hour, a B-2 flies 6,000 miles without refueling. There are 20 in the fleet, based out of Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, with individual aircraft deploying to bases around the world, including ones in Iceland, the Azores, and in Diego Garcia. Flying out of Guam, it will take a B-2 bomber roughly 3 hours to get within striking distance of Pyongyang. So much can happen in 3 hours of nuclear war. The B-2 uses stealth technology to penetrate enemy air defenses without being seen by radar. It is the only long-range, nuclear-capable U.S. aircraft able to perform this feat. Each B-2 has a crew of two. A pilot in the left seat, a commander in the right. The B-2 carries the B-61 Mod 12 thermonuclear gravity bomb, also known as a nuclear bunker buster because of its earth-penetrating component, which makes it more effective at destroying deeply buried targets. Targets like the bunkers that North Korea TMS Supreme Leader is presently suspected to be hiding inside. The main advantage of the B-61-12 is that it packs all the gravity bomb capabilities against all the targeting scenarios into one bomb, a nuclear weapons expert Hans Christensen tells us. That spans from very low-yield tactical A-cleaner TMUs with low fallout, to more dirty attacks against underground targets. The B-2 stealth bomber is the most expensive aircraft in history. And the most effective. But what the generals in the Pentagon know, and no one really wants to say, is that loading nuclear weapons onto the aircraft takes time. Coupled with the requisite flight time, by the time the B-2S get anywhere near Pyongyang in a scenario such as this, a general nuclear war will be well underway. Which also means that by the time the $2 billion stealth aircraft needs fuel, given where the B-2 bomber is going, there will be nowhere to refuel, and nowhere to land. 13 minutes, Mount Weather, Virginia. The administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency is being driven along Highway 267, toward Dulles Airport to catch a flight, when his driver is notified by the Department of Homeland Security to pull over and wait for a FEMA search and rescue team. The team is just minutes away from the FEMA chief at TMS location and will pick him up along the side of the road. The White House is invoking a ETH program. A as chief of FEMA, he will be taken by helicopter to the Mount Weather Emergency Operations Center, as is protocol. The highway pickup is but one element of nuclear crisis protocols that were first put in place back in the early days of the Cold War. In the 1950s, President Eisenhower created the U.S. highway system with this kind of dual use in mind. He modeled America TMS original AO national system of interstate and defense highways after AETH superlative system of German Autobahn, he wrote in his presidential memoirs. Not only could U.S. highways facilitate large-scale evacuation of cities in a nuclear war, but the broad, flat interstate lanes could be used as runways for takeoff and landings on bombing runs. For setting down a helicopter in the median strip, or along the side of the road in the grass. This is how many of America TMS mid-century transportation systems were designed. FEMA is the government entity assigned to prepare for nuclear war. Its special access programs are highly classified. They also hide, or obscure, a misperception. The truth is, there is no federal agency to help citizens survive a nuclear war per se. What FEMA does is focus on how to save specific government officials in the event of a nuclear attack. This is part of a classified FEMA program built upon classified information called the Continuity of Operations Plan, or COOP. The programmer in government speak. This is not to be confused with the Continuity of Government program, former FEMA Director Craig Fugate clarifies. There is the Continuity of Government and then there is the Continuity of Operations Plan, Fugate explains. Continuity of Government is the constitutional succession of the acting president and agency heads. The Continuity of Operations program is the essential functions at TM list that agencies are required to identify, and to be able to reconstitute, or reconstruct, those essential functions, ATM on a very bad day. As for what constitutes a very bad day, Fugate says, AOTATATMS the euphemism for nuclear war. The job of FEMA after the invocation of a ETH programmer boils down to a basic, terrifying concept. AO, can you keep enough of the government intact?